This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
Let's give Joseph Smith the ability to be a human prophet, like all prophets are, a minister for God, but let's not ask of him things that God never asked of him or expected of him.
Coming up next on the Joseph Smith Papers, more from Revelations and Translations, Volume 1.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
This is our third program regarding the first two volumes of the Joseph Smith Papers recently published. Tonight we'll continue our discussion where we left off with Revelations and Translations, Volume 1. Our hope is that the scholars will not only show us better how to use the book, but also they'll expand our understanding of Joseph Smith and the revelatory process. Now we begin in November 1831 with that conference where it was decided to publish the Revelations in the first place.
Stephen C. Harper.
Joseph Smith had told the leaders of the church, "You can just as well rend the veil today as any other day if you'll just exercise enough faith." Well, a week later, a lot of those same church leaders are met in another conference in Hiram, Ohio. And here they're determining to publish the Book of Commandments and Revelations. They're going to publish 10,000 copies. They're going to make themselves poor doing it. It's just the most remarkable vote of confidence in Joseph Smith's revelations that you can imagine. But there's also a great desire on the part of these men to have a kind of spiritual witness of the revelations. I think they must be looking for an experience similar to the three witnesses, to what the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon experienced. That's their precedent. And section 67 of the Doctrine and Covenants just hints that they'd been promised something. That they'd been promised something like a ministering angel or the voice of God or something like that. They don't get it. They seek it. Nothing happens. They don't get it. They wonder why. And they ask for and receive section 67 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Now, that's another discussion. The document that I want to talk about, though, is one that grows out of this discussion, and it's a document that we had not had a manuscript of or that we knew of until we discovered the Book of Commandments and Revelations. It is a testimony. Joseph Smith, during this conference, asks the brethren, "What testimony are you willing to bear of the commandments that are just about to go forth?" And then at some point he receives and writes or has written this testimony. It's on page 121 of the Book of Commandments and Revelations, the only known manuscript of it on the planet. And it is a potent declaration that we know that these revelations are true, and we give our voice, our names to the world. Now the document was copied into the Book of Commandments and Revelations by John Whitmer. And he copied also the signatures of the first half dozen or so witnesses, including the Johnsons and William McClellan. McClellan, who had tried to mimic one of the revelations during the same conference. Then there are several other names that are subscribed below it. And these names aren't copied by John Whitmer. They are in the handwriting of the various men who wrote. And as John Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery carry the Book of Commandments and Revelations out to Missouri now, several men along the way at conference meetings sign their name to the testimony of the witnesses of the Book of the Lord's Commandments. And my favorite is a very light, very faint pencil signature of Levi Hancock. And then off to the side, he has put, "Never to be erased." Never to be erased. So here's Levi Hancock wanting to go on record that he is one of the witnesses that Joseph Smith is a revelator. And he doesn't want that testimony ever to be erased.
Robin S. Jensen.
He was very willing and very dedicated to the revelations. He knew they were of God. He not only showed that by moving to Missouri or by following Joseph Smith, but by putting his name on paper and telling whoever would read that, that this name would never be erased. I find it a tremendous view into the early saints' view on these revelations.
This is Revelations and Translations, Volume 1. Now this book showcases two manuscript compilations of Joseph Smith's revelations. We've seen them both before. The first is the Book of Commandments and Revelations, and the second, the Kirtland Revelation Book.
The Kirtland Revelation Book was begun in early 1832. John Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery had been appointed in November of 1831 to take the revelations to Missouri to have them published. They did this. They arrived in Missouri in early 1832, but that created a void of revelation record keeping in Ohio. So what happened, Joseph Smith received several revelations throughout late 1831, early 1832. They seem to be copied in various places, but we don't have one single repository for all the revelations. As you read section 76, the vision given to Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon about the 3 degrees of glory, the Spirit commands them on 4 different occasions to write this down. The Kirtland Revelation book was begun less than 2 weeks after the section 76 was given. What I think happened was that Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon were so impressed to copy, to write down the vision, that they did so, and they went out and bought a brand new book in order to copy the vision down. And then what's interesting is that after section 76, there seems to be a very short period in which they don't know what to do with the book. They copy in a revelation, they copy in kind of a journal entry. It's almost as if they're not sure what to do with it. And then it later becomes this repository wherein they copy all the revelations that were received by Joseph Smith.
As you'll notice here on this cover shot of the volume, it's called a facsimile edition.
So for the first volume of the Revelation and Translation series, we're producing what's called the facsimile edition. This is a tremendous opportunity for users to see both the image of the document and a transcription of that document. They can see the document in all its glory there in the image, and then if they can't read something or if there's a feature of the document that's just very difficult to see, they can look at the transcription where we have been able to uncover a lot of the detail that isn't readily apparent even in a nice quality image. The transcription itself is also very different than what's found in the journal's volume. We're producing this volume, the transcription of the first volume of the Revelations and Translation series, in what we call a typographical facsimile. So that means if there is a word written above a line in the manuscript, we will typeset that word above the line in the transcription. Every line break in the manuscript is preserved in the transcription. So you can follow the image at every line, and it will be exactly as it is in the manuscript on the transcription itself. I can't tell you the hours and hours and hours it has taken to check, double-check, triple-check the transcription, because literally every word has to be positioned on the page where it is on the manuscript. To make matters even more complicated, we have 5 or 6 individuals working at any given time on the Book of Commandments and Revelations. John Whitmer was the principal scribe, but he also went back at a later time and made additions or revisions. Oliver Cowdery, Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, W.W. Phelps, all of these individuals went back and made corrections to the text. Now, that's a very complicated situation to preserve, to present in a transcription. So what we've done is we've color-coded all of the revisions. So anytime on the transcription you see something in purple, you know that that was Sidney Rigdon making that change. Anytime you see something in green, you will know that that's John Whitmer making a change. And so what we have, basically, is a transcription with all of the revisions, all of the additions where they're at, and then all of these revisions in different color according to the scribe that made them.
Photographic images, such as the ones you see here, well, not only are they visually appealing and enhancing to the text, but they also give us the opportunity to come very close to those original documents of the Restoration.
Another striking feature of the published first volume of the journal, Revelations and Translation Series, is the images that we'll provide. Great care has gone into providing the images of every single manuscript page. So we've had a professional photographer go through and make a digital image of every single page, which at 300 and some odd pages, that was quite a process. But each of these images will be produced in the volume in full color so that readers can see the image and then they will be able to compare it with the transcription. So at each two-page spread of the volume, you will have one manuscript page, and that will go page after page after page, where readers can get a feel, a real feel of the entire volume, the manuscript volume. We're basically presenting the text in the most accessible, most easy to understand process that we can think of. And I think users will use the volume in a variety of different ways. The image is striking to see the handwritten word. The transcription is very critical in understanding the textual elements that might not be easily seen in the manuscript itself.
Now, as we saw in the first volume of the Joseph Smith Papers, there is also in this one, the second, certain tools that are placed to help the reader better understand.
A lot of these revelations are copied out of order. They're not in chronological order in any way. So we have a sort of a table of contents. And we also identify the revelations by when it was received, the date it was received. We do provide a section number, a current section number, so DNC 20, for instance. But if readers want to go from their current DNC to the revelations found in this volume, it will be a bit tricky. We've provided all of the revelations in chronological order so that they can easily see where Revelation is in the volume.
One of those revelations is what we know today as Doctrine and Covenants, section 47. Now, behind that revelation, there's an interesting story and also a lesson.
John Whitmer comes to Joseph Smith, and Joseph says, "Brother John, we really would like you. We need you in the church to keep the history, to keep the church record and the history of the church." And John says, "I'd rather not do it." How many of us have thought that about a calling that came our way, perhaps? So John Whitmer says, "I'd rather not do it. But if it's the will of the Lord, I will." So Joseph the seer inquires, and we know this because John Whitmer tells us, both in the Book of Commandments and Revelations and in his own history later. He tells us in both sources, Joseph inquires, receives the revelation, Doctrine and Covenants, section 47, and John Whitmer does the calling that he's called to because the Lord asked him to through Joseph Smith the seer. Here again is a man who knows Joseph Smith well. He's intimate with him. Joseph has lived in the Whitmer home. John Whitmer has scribed for Joseph for a long time in the early days of the church. He knows him well. They've sat together intimately and in council and writing. And here's a man who says, "Joseph, I don't really care what you want me to do, but if the Lord wants me to do it, I will." How does John Whitmer know what the Lord wants? Joseph Smith the seer will reveal it. And John credits that revelation as authentic. So my larger point is that these early saints saw Joseph Smith as both seer and regular mortal. And Joseph Smith saw himself that way. He's on record a half a dozen times saying that. He struggled to try to help the saints understand and appreciate that. And I fear that at this historical distance, we may be in danger of missing that distinction. One thing I hope that folks will see when they look at the Revelation books that have just been published in Revelations and Translations Volume 1, one thing I hope they'll see is what the contemporaries of Joseph Smith saw, and that is evidence of Joseph Smith the Revelator and Joseph Smith the Farmer on the same pages as his revelations make it onto the page.
Now, often when Joseph Smith received a revelation, it was because someone had a question, or there were circumstances that arose that required the prophet to inquire of the Lord. Now, given that then, the more we know of those historical events that brought forth the revelation, the better able we are to understand the revelation.
Let me start by talking about one of the most exciting features of the Book of Commandments and Revelations, and that is John Whitmer's historical headnotes. So in the first of these books, John Whitmer writes in great big letters, 23rd commandment, for example, or 29th commandment. He gives them each a number, and he calls them commandments. Occasionally he'll call them revelation, but most often commandments. And then he'll follow with a date, place, and then a sentence or two about the context of the revelation. Now, that readers or viewers might think, well, that's what we have, you know, in our heading of our Doctrine and Covenants. And that's true to a degree, but I can't emphasize to you enough how rich these little tiny headings are with knowledge that we have not known before. Dates, places, chronologies, causes and effects, reasons for certain revelations being given that we'd had no idea of before. Now we know. Just small bits of information, but it opens our minds so much wider than it was before. Let me give you one of my favorite examples. This is John Whitmer's 29th commandment in the Book of Commandments and Revelations. Happens, just by coincidence, to be Doctrine and Covenants, section 29 as well. This is one of the most theologically profound revelations that we have. It is a masterpiece. It starts by redefining the elect. The elect aren't the Calvinist ones who are predetermined to grace by an arbitrary sovereign God, but rather the elect hear my voice and harden not their hearts, as verse 7 of section 29 says. And the first verses also talk about those who come to God and choose Him. The elect are those who choose God when given their free will. And so we get very quickly a redefinition of the elect, and the elders are told it's their job to gather them. But then we transition into an extended passage about creation, the creation in abstract. The Lord says, this is the first of my work. I create spiritually and then temporally. And then I create temporally and then spiritually. And that's the last of my work. And when I read those verses, my mind just feels so stretched. I cannot quite fathom what He means. And it's as if He understands that. And then says, let me give you an example. Adam, whom I created. And then he just takes Adam as an example. Every person, Adam, and explains how Adam was created, given a commandment, given his agency, exposed to temptations, yielded unto temptation. Because he yielded unto temptation, he became subject to the will of the devil. And then we have the whole narrative of the fall and redemption from the fall through the atonement of the Lord Jesus Christ. It is a profound piece of theology. It is a masterpiece. Well, we've known that for a long time. What we haven't known is why it was given. It just seemed to come out of the blue. Now we know from John Whitmer's little heading that a bunch of members of the church had gathered for conference, and they, John Whitmer says, thought it was time that the saints would see eye to eye. And they didn't see eye to eye, he says, on the question of Adam's death or Adam's transgression, his fall. These are Latter-day Saints that have come from all over the theological spectrum. They don't see eye to eye. They have a difference of opinion on the nature of the fall. They say, we asked Joseph, Joseph asked the Lord, and the Lord gave us section 29, and it answers their question. it's quite remarkable that we now can see that they had a specific question, and the very specific answer is right there in the Revelation. So we have that for, I've never counted, but I'd say for a dozen or more revelations, we now have a much clearer sense of the reason why the revelation was given.
The Book of Commandments and Revelations, which is within this volume, well, it adds greatly to our understanding of the context of some of these revelations. For example, with some, the date on which they were given was unknown. But thanks to the BCR, scholars now know when those dates are, and that's important.
There are other very interesting things in the Book of Commandments and Revelations. One of them is an appendix, or John Whitmer called it an index of contents. It's at the very end of the book, and it is something like a cross between an index and a table of contents. On the left-hand side of the page, two pages, John Whitmer writes the year in which the revelations were given, so 1830 down through 1831, 2, and so on. And then he will write in the center of the page a commandment given to Oliver Cowdery, a commandment to Joseph and Martin, a commandment to Joseph, the father of the seer, for Joseph Smith's father. And then on the far right of the page, in the far right column, he'll put the page number of the Book of Commandments and Revelations on which that revelation begins. And we might think, well, that's lovely, a table of contents, but the real value of it, one of the real values of it, is it gives us information we didn't ever have before. And it confirms some things that had been up in the air before. We hadn't known for sure. We haven't been able to be positive whether Section 10 of the Doctrine and Covenants was given in the summer of 1828 or in the summer, early summer of 1829. And it makes a bit of a difference. That revelation, as you know, tells Joseph not to retranslate the material that was on the lost 116 pages. So is Joseph asking for that revelation right after he loses those pages and before he translates the rest of the Book of Mormon? Or is he asking for that revelation after he translates the rest of the Book of Mormon and just about before he's ready to go to press with it or get ready to go to press with it? So it makes a difference historically when that revelation comes. And it comes in May of 1829, according to the Book of Commandments and Revelations. It confirms all of the earliest sources that say 1829 or May 1829. But Joseph's later history simply says a few days after Section 3, I got Section 10. Or it implies that that's the case.
And there are other things about the modern-day Doctrine and Covenants that Revelations and Translations, Volume 1, clarify.
Joseph's later history says that Section 39 of the Doctrine and Covenants came because a man named James Colville, whom Joseph says was a Baptist minister for 40 years, asked for a revelation. He said he'd be willing to do anything the Lord revealed through Joseph Smith. So the Lord gave Section 39. James Colville decided not to do what Section 39 said, and the Lord subsequently gave Section 40 to explain to Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon why not. Well, it's not a very important thing, but we had looked for James Colville for years in Baptist records. Been a Baptist minister for 40 years. He's got to show up in the Baptist records. But he doesn't. And then when we read the Index of Contents in the Book of Commandments and Revelations, it says, given to James, a Methodist priest. So based on that, just that tiny bit of information, historian Sherilyn Farnes started looking in Methodist records, and there he is. He shows up. 1791 is when he becomes a Methodist minister. 40 years he's a Methodist minister before receiving the revelation.
Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, we will tell you the story of one of Joseph Smith's revelations with a most unique history. It's a revelation for which the modern church has become famous and its members identified. Which one is it? The Word of Wisdom. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.